Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary? That's the question a room full of people who knew and loved Jesus asked when they witnessed his divine authority. They were not strangers or enemies. They were the people who watched him grow up. Today we are pairing this question Jesus faced with one that we all have to face sometime in our lives. Who do you think you are? Hi, Living Life family. Welcome back to Hard Questions from Mark. We are 5 weeks into this season, and if you've been with me since week one, you know what we are doing here. We're taking the questions people ask in the Gospel of Mark and holding it up next to the questions in our own hearts right now. So before we get into it, grab this week's work pages on my website at samanthashambo.com. There's space there to sit with a couple of these questions on your own. And if this episode lands for you today, would you send it to one person? I'd really appreciate it. My husband Philly and I have spent 5 years pastoring and teaching in Mozambique. I learned Portuguese in 3 months, and that surprised even me. I helped advance children's ministry across the district. I taught at a Bible school and counseled young married couples. And God kept moving the walls that I had around what I thought I was capable of. I felt useful and in my element. Then the call came that we were being sent home because Philemo was needed back in our church's regional office in South Africa. My first feeling was pure joy. I pictured being near my family again and serving Jesus amongst my own people. We moved back to my own hometown in El Dorado Park and back to the local church where we were serving before we left for Mozambique. Our people warmly welcomed us back and it felt good to be home. But it wasn't home for 1 month before I started feeling uneasy. There was no role for me there, and it wasn't because I had lost anything. I was the same woman who had just spent 5 years leading, teaching, and preaching. But there was no place for me to serve, and that made me feel invisible. It genuinely felt like there was just no need for me in the church in South Africa. So I ended up teaching in a high school instead. Within months, I felt myself doing something I never saw coming. I was shrinking. Being back home had regressed me into the scared, insecure little girl that I used to be. It was like the 5 years in Mozambique had never happened. That experience helped me to understand this moment in Nazareth, where Jesus came back to his people and there was no space for him. So let's look at the story in Mark 6, verse 1 to 6. Jesus had just done back-to-back things that should leave no room for doubt. He calmed a storm with just a word. He freed a man that was tormented by demons. He healed a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years by just a touch of his garment. And he raised a little girl from her own deathbed. And then Mark tells us he left that place and went to his hometown accompanied by his disciples. He teaches in the synagogue on a Sabbath, and Mark says the people were amazed. This is the same amazement that the disciples felt in the boat, and the same astonishment that followed him everywhere that he went. So far, Nazareth is tracking with everyone else. And then we see a turn in their response. Where did this man get these things? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? And Mark closes the scene with one devastating line. And they took offense at him. This is how their response develops. They are amazed. Then they compared him with what they already knew about him. And then they rejected him. It was a specific, deliberate refusal to accept what they were witnessing. The evidence wasn't the problem. They just had nowhere to file it. They deliberately belittled Jesus. Isn't this the carpenter? That was an insult because criticism of social background was a standard way of putting people in their place in the first century. They also intensified the insult by calling him the son of Mary. This was unusual because in those days people were referred to by their father's names. Calling someone by their mother's name was a way of belittling them. The reasons for the rejection aren't a mystery. They're about how status worked in that village and how it still works in ours. In Jesus' world, who you were wasn't something that you earned. It was something you were given at birth, and mostly it stayed put. Your family, your trade, your place in the town, that was your identity, full stop. Everyone around you had a stake in keeping it that way, because a stable, predictable social order is what let a small village survive. So when Nazareth reaches for a description of Jesus, they don't reach for what they watched him do. They reach for what they've always called him, the trade, the mother's name, the brothers and the sisters who still live two doors down. This is more than an insult. They wanted to keep Jesus in the place they thought he should occupy. In essence, they were saying, "We know exactly who you are, and this isn't it." It would be easy to take this and turn it straight into a message about you. How people don't recognize your growth and how unfair that is. We're going to get there. But that's not primarily what this passage is trying to do here. Mark isn't telling us a story about a man whose neighbors failed to notice his personal development. He's telling us how people respond to the revelation of Jesus and challenging us to think about our own response to God's revelation. The people who knew Jesus best, who had known him the longest, who loved him, were the very ones least able to see who he actually was. Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of God, standing in the middle of their synagogue. But their familiarity closed their eyes to the miracle that was unfolding right in front of them. If familiarity could do that to the people looking directly at the Son of God, it's a warning against how easily we misjudge what's standing right in front of us. And this isn't just a first century problem. Sociologists have a name for exactly what Nazareth is doing. They call it a person's master status, the one label that becomes the lens everyone views them through, no matter what else is true and no matter how much has changed. Once a community assigns you a role, it takes real, sustained evidence to get them to file you under anything else. Most communities would rather keep the old file than open a new one. You've probably felt a smaller version of this yourself. The sibling who is still the messy one at 35, the friend who made a mistake in college and can't outrun it 15 years later, or the co-worker who gets promoted and immediately runs into people who still only see her as the assistant. Nazareth had already filed Jesus under carpenter, son of Mary, one of the neighborhood kids. They weren't about to reopen that file for a rumor about wisdom and power, however well attested. That's exactly why Jesus names out loud in response. Prophets are not without honor, except in their own hometown and among their own kin and in their own house. Jesus isn't surprised. He's naming the pattern out loud while it was happening to him. Mark doesn't seem to think that this kind of blindness stays contained in one synagogue or in one town. Two chapters later, Jesus turns to his own disciples, the ones closest to him, who had left everything to follow him, and he asks them outright, "Who do people say that I am?" This shows us that recognizing Jesus wasn't a question you get to answer once and be done with it. Familiarity can keep a whole hometown from seeing what God is doing in Jesus. And it can easily keep us from seeing what God is doing in the people around us. It can also keep us from seeing what God is doing in ourselves. But I don't want you to leave this thinking that the moral of the story is the people who know you are your enemies, or that God's call on your life requires you to write off your family, your church, or the place that you are from. That's not what's happening here, and it's not what I'm asking you to do. Many of the people who know your history should have a voice in your life. That's part of how God keeps us honest and undeceived about ourselves. The issue in Nazareth wasn't that people who knew Jesus had opinions about him. It was that they let what they already know stop them from looking at the story that was developing right in front of them. There's a difference between someone who loves you enough to tell you the truth and someone who's decided the truth can't include anything that they haven't approved. So how does this actually show up in us? I think there are two shapes this takes in our lives. The first shape is being kept. Maybe it's your family. You're the one who got the degree, who got free, got sober, got called. And the people who watched you at your worst still only know how to talk to you like you were still. Maybe it's your faith community. Sometimes the hardest room to be seen as who God is making you is the very room that watched you become a Christian in the first place. Because they fell in love with your beginning and they just never updated their file. And sometimes the one keeping you filed under who you used to be is you. We usually put ourselves on the Nazareth side of the story, but plenty of us are also standing in the synagogue, refusing to believe God could actually be doing something new in us. Who am I to think that I could do that? There's a well-documented pull in people towards staying knowable over being known differently. We'd almost rather be seen accurately as small than be misunderstood as something bigger. It just feels safer. The second way this shows up is keeping. Being kept is something that happens to you. Keeping is something that you do. This one is harder to sit with because it's easy to hear this whole episode and only ever cast yourself as Jesus. Poor me. Nobody recognizes what I've become. But sometimes in your life, you are also the hometown. Whom have you already filed under the carpenter, the son of Mary? Whom are you still relating to as the person they were 5 or 10 years ago, before they got free or called, before they got healed? Because that old file is so much easier to keep open than to work on actually looking at them again. We can even do this to God. Jesus reveals himself to us progressively. But sometimes we get stuck on one idea of Jesus and we refuse to see all that he is. For example, your first experience of Jesus is pure love, and this led you to believe in him and to become a child of God. However, now Jesus might want to reveal his holiness to you and want to challenge you to grow in Christian maturity. Are you open to the discomfort that such a shift would demand from you? So, what do you actually do when you're the one that Nazareth won't see? Mark doesn't leave this question hanging. Look at what happens in the very next verses. Jesus doesn't stay in Nazareth trying to win the argument. Mark simply tells us that he went around the surrounding villages teaching, and then he turned around and sent the 12 out even further than that. Rejection never became his defining label. He focused on his mission. I think Mark 6, verses 6 to 13 gives us 3 instructions we can actually use to move forward. First, keep moving. Jesus didn't spend his ministry trying to make Nazareth take back what they said about him. He kept teaching, he kept healing, he kept walking towards the next village. If you make it your life's mission to get that one room, or that old church to finally see you differently, you can spend years waiting on people who may never open a new file on you. Let becoming who God is calling you to be matter more than winning the argument, because half of the time, it's an argument that's only happening in your own head. Second, travel light. Mark isn't talking about emotional baggage here. He's talking about provisions. Jesus tells the 12 not to pack extra, not to build their security around what they are carrying, but to depend on God's provision and on whatever welcome they are given, even though the welcome is not always guaranteed. But there's a principle of dependence here that I don't want you to miss. If I need Nazareth before I obey God, Nazareth still has power over me that it was never supposed to have. You can't control whether people will receive you. You can only control whether you stay faithful to what God has actually put in your hands. Third, shake off the dust. Jesus tells the 12 plainly, if a town won't welcome you, leave and shake the dust off your feet as you go. Don't stay until they come around or argue until they listen. Don't carry the town's rejection to the next one. You can leave a place and still carry its dust for years, replaying the rejection in every new room, turning every new accomplishment into an argument with someone who isn't even in your life anymore. You may have left Nazareth a long time ago. The question worth asking is whether Nazareth's dust left with you. However, here's one more layer that I want you to notice. None of this means that every closed door is persecution, or that being rejected automatically proves that you were right. The question was never whether everybody approved of you. And it's also not whether people rejected you, so you must be doing something holy. The only question that actually matters is whether you are still faithfully doing what God sent you to do. And here's what I love. Nazareth closes their doors, and Jesus' mission expands outward. He goes into the villages. Then the 12 go out two by two. What looks like a moment of rejection is followed almost immediately by multiplication. So maybe the answer to being boxed in isn't about breaking the box open by force. Maybe it's about continuing to follow Jesus, to keep being obedient, to keep going, and to leave the dust where it fell. This is the anchor underneath everything else today. Your identity was never Nazareth's to assign, and it was never yours to earn either. It doesn't come from the shelf your hometown built for you, and it doesn't come from how impressively you outgrow it. It comes from the same place it came from for Jesus, from being deeply known and loved by God before anyone in that synagogue had an opinion about him at all. Mark tells us that Jesus couldn't do many deeds of power there, except for a few people that he healed. Their unbelief was their loss. Mark tells us that Jesus was amazed and genuinely astonished at the hometown that had every kind of evidence in front of them and still couldn't see him. Whatever was happening in that gap, their rejection cost them something, and it didn't cost him who he was. So, here's your Living Life challenge for this week. Name the old version of yourself you are still performing somewhere, in a relationship, in a room, or in your own head. You don't have to fix it this week, just name it. Then think of one person you are still relating to as who they used to be. Ask God honestly whether it's time to close that old file and to allow them to surprise you. Then name one piece of dust you are still carrying from an old rejection into new rooms or new relationships or new opportunities. Then ask what it would look like to actually leave that dust where it fell and to keep walking towards what God is calling you to do. I'd love to hear how this one lands for you. Come find me on Facebook and Instagram, YouTube, or on my website at SamanthaShambo.com. Please tell me where you saw yourself in Nazareth this week, or where you are the one being asked to see someone in a new light. Thank you for joining me today. Remember, no matter your story, in Christ you are deeply known, fully loved, and you have a divine purpose. Until next time, keep living love.